Chapter 44. Not so very, my son. With his own voice the Lord called him. Yes, sir, and had to call him a couple times before he could come. And then I sallied forth, and that stern old man sallied forth after me. He overtook me at noon the following day, and when the interview was over I had acquired the name of Samuel, and a thrashing, and other useful information. And by means of this compromise my father's wrath was appeased, and a misunderstanding bridged over which might have become a permanent rupture, if I had chosen to be unreasonable. But just judging by this episode, what would my father have done to me, if I had ever uttered in his hearing one of the flat, sickly things these woe years old say in print nowadays? In my opinion there would have been a case of infanticide in our family. An entertaining article, I take the following paragraph from an article in the Boston Advertiser. An English critic on Mark Twain, perhaps the most successful flights of humor of Mark Twain, have been descriptions of the persons who did not appreciate his humor at all. We have become familiar with the Californians who were thrilled with terror by his burlesque of a newspaper reporter's way of telling a story, and we have heard of the Pennsylvania clergyman who sadly returned his innocence abroad to the book agent with the remark that the man who could shed tears over the tomb of Adam must be an idiot. But Mark Twain may now add a much more glorious instance to his string of trophies. The Saturday Review, in its number of October 8th, reviews his book of travels, which has been republished in England, and reviews it seriously. We can imagine the delight of the humorist in reading this tribute to his power, and indeed it is so amusing in itself that he can hardly do better than reproduce the article in full in his next monthly memoranda. Publishing the above paragraph thus gives me a sort of authority for reproducing the Saturday Review's article in full in these pages. I dearly wanted to do it, for I cannot write anything half so delicious myself. If I had a cast iron dog that could read this English criticism and preserve his austerity, I would drive him off the doorstep. From the London Saturday Review. Reviews of new books, The Innocents Abroad. A Book of Travels. By Mark Twain. London. Houghton, Publisher. 1870. Lord Macaulay died too soon. We never felt this so deeply as when we finished the last chapter of the above-named extravagant work. Macaulay died too soon, for none, but he could mete out complete and comprehensive justice to the insolence, the impertinence, the presumption, the mendacity, and, above all, the majestic ignorance of this author. To say that The Innocents Abroad is a curious book would be to use the faintest language, would be to speak of the Matterhorn as a neat elevation, or of Niagara as being icer ready. Curious is too tame a word wherewith to describe the imposing insanity of this work. There is no word that is large enough or long enough. Let us, therefore, photograph a passing glimpse of book and author, and trust the rest to the reader. Let the cultivated English student of human nature picture to himself this Mark Twain as a person capable of doing the following described things, and not only doing them, but with incredible innocence printing them calmly and tranquilly in a book. For instance, he states that he entered a hairdresser's in Paris to get shaved, and the first ache the barber gave him with his razor it loosened his hide, and lifted him out of the chair. This is unquestionably exaggerated. In Florence he was so annoyed by beggars, that he pretends to have seized and eaten one in a frantic spirit of revenge. There is, of course, no truth in this. He gives at full length a theatrical program 17 or 1800 years old, which he professes to have found in the ruins of the Colosseum, among the dirt and mold and rubbish. It is a sufficient comment upon this statement to remark that even a cast iron program would not have lasted so long under such circumstances. In Greece he plainly betrays both fright and flight upon one occasion, but with frozen effrontery puts the latter in this falsely tame form. We sidled toward the Piraeus. Idled, indeed. He does not hesitate to intimate that at Ephesus, when his mule strayed from the proper course, he got down, took him under his arm, carried him to the road again, pointed him right, remounted, and went to sleep contentedly till it was time to restore the beast to the path once more. He states that a growing youth among his ship's passengers was in the constant habit of appeasing his hunger with soap and oakum between meals. In Palestine he tells of ants that came 11 miles to spend the summer in the desert and brought their provisions with them. Yet he shows by his description of the country that the feat was an impossibility. He mentions, as if it were the most commonplace of matters, that he cut a Muslim in two in broad daylight in Jerusalem, with Gottfried de Bouillon's sword, and would have shed more blood, if he had had a graveyard of his own. These statements are unworthy a moment's attention. Mr. Twain or any other foreigner who did such a thing in Jerusalem would be mobbed, and would infallibly lose his life. But why go on? Why repeat more of his audacious and exasperating falsehoods? Let us close fittingly with this one. He affirms that in the Mosque of St. Sophia at Constantinople I got my feet so stuck up with a complication of gums, slime, and general impurity, that I wore out more than 2,000 pair of bootjacks getting my boots off that night, and even then some Christian hide peeled off with them. It is monstrous. Such statements are simply lies, there is no other name for them. Will the reader longer marvel at the brutal ignorance that pervades the American nation when we tell him that we are informed upon perfectly good authority that this extravagant compilation of falsehoods, this exhaustless mine of stupendous lies, this innocence abroad, has actually been adopted by the schools and colleges of several of the states as a textbook? But if his falsehoods are distressing, his innocence and his ignorance are enough to make one burn the book and despise the author. In one place he was so appalled at the sudden spectacle of a murdered man, unveiled by the moonlight, that he jumped out of the window, going through sash and all, and then remarks with the most childlike simplicity that he is not scared, but was considerably agitated. It puts us out of patience to note that the simpleton is densely unconscious that Lucrezia Borgia ever existed off the stage. He is vulgarly ignorant of all foreign languages, but is frank enough to criticize the Italians' use of their own tongue. He says they spell the name of their great painter Inzi, but pronounce it Vinci, and then adds with a not colon ivata possible only to helpless ignorance, foreigners always spell better than they pronounce. In another place he commits the bald absurdity of putting the phrase are nouns into an Italian's mouth. In Rome he unhesitatingly believes the legend that St. Philip Neri's heart was so inflamed with divine love that it burst his ribs, believes it holy, because an author with a learned list of university degrees strung after his name endorses it otherwise. Says this gentle idiot, I should have felt a curiosity to know what Philip had for dinner. Our author makes a long, fatiguing journey to the Grotto del Cane on purpose to test its poisoning powers on a dog got elaborately ready for the experiment, and then discovered that he had no dog. A wiser person would have kept such a thing discreetly to himself, but with this harmless creature everything comes out. He hurts his foot in a rut 2,000 years old in exhumed Pompeii, and presently, when staring at one of the cinder-like corpses unearthed in the next square, conceives the idea that maybe it is the remains of the ancient street commissioner, and straightway his horror softens down to a sort of chirpy contentment with the condition of things. In Damascus he visits the well of Ananias, 3,000 years old, and is as surprised and delighted as a child to find that the water is as pure and fresh as if the well had been dug yesterday. In the Holy Land he gags desperately at the hard Arabic and Hebrew biblical names, and finally concludes to call them Baldwinsville, Williamsburg, and so on, for convenience of spelling. We have thus spoken freely of this man's stupefying simplicity and innocence, but we cannot deal similarly with his colossal ignorance. We do not know where to begin. And if we knew where to begin, we certainly would not know where to leave off. We will give one specimen, and one only. He did not know, until he got to Rome, that Michelangelo was dead. And then, instead of crawling away, and hiding his shameful ignorance somewhere, he proceeds to express a pious, grateful sort of satisfaction, that he is gone, and out of his troubles. No, the reader may seek out the author's exhibition of his uncultivation for himself. The book is absolutely dangerous, considering the magnitude and variety of its misstatements, and the convincing confidence with which they are made. And yet it is a textbook in the schools of America. The poor blunderer mouses among the sublime creations of the old masters, trying to acquire the elegant proficiency in art knowledge, which he has a groping sort of comprehension is a proper thing for a traveled man, to be able to display. But what is the manner of his study? And what is the progress he achieves? To what extent does he familiarize himself with the great pictures of Italy, and what degree of appreciation does he arrive at? Read. When we see a monk going about with a lion and looking up into heaven, we know that that is Saint Mark. When we see a monk with a book and a pen, looking tranquilly up to heaven, trying to think of a word, we know that that is Saint Matthew. When we see a monk sitting on a rock, looking tranquilly up to heaven, with a human skull beside him, and without other baggage, we know that that is Saint Jerome. Because we know that he always went flying light in the matter of baggage. When we see other monks looking tranquilly up to heaven, but having no trademark, we always ask who those parties are. We do this, because we humbly wish to learn. He then enumerates the thousands and thousands of copies of the several pictures which he has seen, and adds with accustomed simplicity, that he feels encouraged to believe that, when he has seen some more of each, and had a larger experience, he will eventually begin to take an absorbing interest in them, the vulgar boor. That we have shown this to be a remarkable book, we think no one will deny. That is a pernicious book to place in the hands of the confiding and uniformed, we think we have also shown. That the book is a deliberate and wicked creation of a diseased mind, is apparent upon every page. Having placed our judgment thus upon record, let us close with what charity we can, by remarking that even in this volume there is some good to be found. For whenever the author talks of his own country, and lets Europe alone, he never fails to make himself interesting, and not only interesting but instructive. No one can read without benefit his occasional chapters and paragraphs, about life in the gold and silver mines of California and Nevada, about the Indians of the plains and deserts of the West, and their cannibalism, about the raising of vegetables in kegs of gunpowder by the aid of 2 or 3 teaspoons of guano, about the moving of small arms from place to place at night in wheelbarrows to avoid taxes, and about a sort of cows and mules in the Humboldt mines that climb down chimneys and disturb the people at night. These matters are not only new, but are well worth knowing. It is a pity the author did not put in more of the same kind. His book is well written, and is exceedingly entertaining, and so it just barely escaped being quite valuable also. 1 month later, latterly I have received several letters, and see a number of newspaper paragraphs, all upon a certain subject, and all of about the same tenor. I here give honest specimens. One is from a New York paper, one is from a letter from an old friend, and one is from a letter from a New York publisher who is a stranger to me. I humbly endeavor to make these bits toothsome with the remark that the article they are praising, which appeared in the December Galaxy, and pretended to be a criticism from the London Saturday Review on my innocence abroad, was written by myself, every line of it. The Herald says the richest thing out is the eeriest critique in the London Saturday Review, on Mark Twain's Innocence Abroad. We thought before we read it, that it must be eerious, as everybody said so, and were even ready to shed a few tears. But since perusing it, we are bound to confess that next to Mark Twain's Umping Frog, it's the finest bit of humor and sarcasm that we've come across in many a day. I do not get a compliment like that every day. I used to think that your writings were pretty good, but after reading the criticism in the Galaxy from the London Review, I've discovered what an ass I must have been. If suggestions are in order, mine is that you put that article in your next edition of The Innocents as an extra chapter, if you are not afraid to put your own humor in competition with it. It is as rich a thing as I ever read. Which is strong commendation from a book publisher. The London Reviewer, my friend, is not the stupid, serious creature he pretends to be, I think, but, on the contrary, has a keen appreciation and enjoyment of your book. As I read his article in the Galaxy, I could imagine him giving vent to many a hearty laugh. But he is writing for Catholics and established church people, and high-toned, antiquated, conservative gentility, whom it is a delight to him to help you shock, while he pretends to shake his head with owlish density. He is a magnificent humorist himself. Now that is graceful and handsome. I take off my hat to my lifelong friend and comrade, and with my feet together, and my fingers spread over my heart, I say, in the language of Alabama, you do me proud. I stand guilty of the authorship of the article, but I did not mean any harm. I saw by an item in the Boston Advertiser that a solemn, serious critique on the English edition of my book had appeared in the London Saturday Review, and the idea of such a literary breakfast by a stolid, ponderous British ogre of the quill was too much for a naturally weak virtue, and I went home and burlesqued it, reveled in it, I may say. I never saw a copy of the real Saturday Review criticism until after my burlesque was written and mailed to the printer. But when I did get hold of a copy, I found it to be vulgar, awkwardly written, ill-natured, and entirely serious and in earnest. The gentleman who wrote the newspaper paragraph above quoted had not been misled as to its character. If any man doubts my word now, I will kill him. No, I will not kill him. I will win his money. I will bet him 20-1, and let any New York publisher hold the stakes, that the statements I have above made, as to the authorship of the article in question, are entirely true. Perhaps I may get wealthy at this, for I am willing. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.